The headlines. The death toll from Israeli air and artillery strikes in the Gaza Strip exceeds 20,000, with at least 8,000 children among the victims. U.S. Security Council postpones a vote on a bid to send humanitarian aid to Gaza for the third time, amid a threat of veto by the U.S. And sirens sound and explosions are heard in Tel Aviv as resistance forces carry out retaliatory rocket attacks on Israeli cities.
Welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Mews. Thanks for joining us.
It's day 76 of Israel's genocide of the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, and the regime presses ahead with its carpet bombing campaign across the besieged territory. Beginning with the northern Gaza Strip, where a new round of airstrikes on Jabalia killed 9 Palestinians. The World Health Organization says all hospitals in the area are now non-functional. The WHO representative says the situation at Al-Shifa and Al-Ahli hospitals is, quote, beyond catastrophic. In eastern Gaza, even the dead are not spared from Israel's savagery. Reports say the regime's bulldozers have demolished a cemetery in the Saha neighborhood. Locals say the graves have been fully demolished and the dead bodies have been crushed. Israel has killed over 20,000 people, including at least 8,000 children in Gaza, since early October. The United Nations Emergency Relief Coordinator says the surging death toll is a, quote, shameful milestone. People in Gaza are calling for a complete ceasefire as Israel's relentless airstrikes and shelling have displaced hundreds of thousands of Palestinians, leaving them without food, water, and other basic amenities. Let's take a listen to some of the displaced Palestinians in the city of Rafah, narrating about their harrowing experience.
I wish for a complete ceasefire and to put an end to the series of deaths and suffering. It's been more than 76 days. People are still getting killed. There are still people under the rubble. And there are people in Gaza I still don't know anything about them. And the communication is cut.
I wish for a ceasefire so we will be able to return to our home, to our loved ones.
People are tired. They don't have any more energy. We wish that the ceasefire procedures go easy and smooth so that calm and peace prevail in all the Palestinian territories.
We are homeless. We can't go back to our houses. I want to see my children. I want to go back to my husband and to my house. It's unfair. It's so unfair.
Palestinian professor at Al-Azhar University, Mohammer Abu Sara, blames the international community for his failure to end the Israeli onslaught on Gaza.
Let me say that it's very unfortunate that all that number of Palestinians have been killed and injured, the destruction that have been inflicted on the Gaza Strip over the past 76 days. And unfortunately, the international community has so far failed miserably, to be frank with you, to put an end to this onslaught against the Palestinian civilian population in the Gaza Strip. Over more than 2 months and a half, Israel has targeted hospitals, clinics, schools, even UN-run schools, which have been housing Palestinian displaced in the south of Gaza. Has targeted civilian infrastructure, and above all of that, there is mass starvation among the more than 2.3 million Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, because Israel also is blocking the entry of humanitarian assistance to the Palestinians. According to UNICEF, 60% of the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip right now are suffering from starvation, and also, according to UNICEF, the UN organization, Gaza has become the worst place for children all over the world.
He once says the disturbing allegations emerged that Israeli forces summarily killed nearly a dozen Palestinian men in Gaza City, what may amount to a war crime. A report by the UN Human Rights Office in the occupied Palestinian territory says the incident took place in Gaza's Al-Ramal neighborhood on Tuesday. According to witness accounts, the regime forces separated men from the women and children and then shot and killed at least 11 men in front of their loved ones. The deliberate targeting and killing of civilians in Gaza had also been reported before. The UN agency warns that the allegations raised the alarm about the possible commission of a war crime. says that Israel must immediately probe these allegations, bring those responsible to justice. The Israeli occupation forces have yet to comment on the incident. The UN has confirmed the killings, although the details are still under verification. Palestinian scientist and author Massim Ghabzaya earlier joined us with his take on the dire situation in Gaza. He says Israel's military campaign has failed, that the regime is committing genocide to appease its own public.
Genocide continues and, in fact, accelerates because of the starvation and lack of food and medicine and water. And the World Health Organization describes spreading diseases now afflicting about 400,000 Palestinians. So the situation is really, really dire. And words cannot even begin to describe what's going on in the relentless massacre and attack by Israel on the civilian population, which Israel seems to accelerate because they feel that this is the only way they can show some achievement to their own people, is that they are killing Palestinians. The other aspect of it is the military campaign against Hamas and the other resistance forces, and that isn't going too well for Israel. Every day we see videos and reports that show that they are failing in this campaign. They discovered two tunnels, I think, and they managed to kill a couple of people, but most of the deaths have been on the Israeli side, Israeli soldiers and tanks. Hundreds of tanks have already been targeted.
Diplomatic wrangling at the UN Security Council has caused a vote on a draft resolution calling for a ceasefire in Gaza to be postponed to Thursday. Now, diplomatic sources are saying the delay on the vote was at the behest of the U.S. The resolution, sponsored by the United Arab Emirates, calls for the urgent suspension of hostilities to allow safe and unhindered humanitarian access to Gaza, as well as steps toward a sustainable ceasefire. The 15-member council has been grappling for days to find a common ground on the draft. The U.S., Israel's main backer and a permanent Security Council member, had vetoed two previous resolutions on Gaza. The U.S. has used its veto power at least 34 times to block UN resolutions that were critical of Israel. Let's cross on over first to Rafah and have our correspondent Ashraf Shannon join us to tell us more. Well, Ashraf, at this point, what do you have for us that's important of the developments today?
Well, Kaveh, the situation continues to get worse by the day as the Israeli regime forces continue to pound areas in the Gaza Strip, especially in the northern parts of the Gaza Strip, north of the Gaza Creek of the Gaza Wadi. Main attacks concentrating on Shija'iya neighborhood, as well as Jabalia refugee camp and Jabalia city, as well as Beth Lahia, and also areas west of Gaza City, close to Shifa Hospital. Attacks continue also to take place on Kamal Adwan Hospital. That was almost half of it was destroyed by the Israeli regime forces. Basically, the northern parts of the Gaza Strip under nearly full Israeli occupation, while there is fierce resistance by Hamas's military wing, the Azdin Qassam brigades, who said today that the forces have killed and injured dozens of Israeli soldiers over the last 24 hours, especially in the northern parts of Gaza. Meanwhile, the Islamic Jihad's military wing, the Al-Quds Brigade, said today that they managed to down one Israeli drone in northern Gaza. There's heavy losses among the Israeli regime forces, and that can be sensed by following the Israeli media, with a lot of demonstrations taking place within the Israeli regime, not against the Israeli war in Gaza, but demanding the release of Israeli prisoners that are held by Hamas. Meanwhile, in Egypt, Hamas's political bureau chief Ismail Haniyeh has been discussing with the Egyptian politicians the situation in the occupied Gaza Strip, especially delivering aid, urgent aid to the Gaza Strip, while Hamas officials have denied agreeing to any form of prisoner exchange. Hamas says that any prisoner exchange will only take place, and again, will only take place after a full
ceasefire that takes effect in the Gaza Strip. The Israeli regime is trying to create some sort of a prolonged humanitarian pause in exchange for some 36 Israeli prisoners in Gaza, but Hamas has refused so far, and it seems that Hamas will not agree to such terms by the Israeli regime.
Thank you very much for that. Ashraf Shannon there, talking to us from Rafah. Thank you. Palestinian resistance fighters have intensified retaliatory operations against Israeli forces inside and outside of the besieged Gaza Strip. The military wing of the Hamas resistance movement said at least 35 rockets have been fired deep into Israel. The regime's media said explosions were heard in Tel Aviv and north of the occupied territories. No casualties have been reported so far. Inside Gaza, the Qassam brigades hit an Israeli Merkava tank along with a group of soldiers. As a result, casualties were inflicted on the military. Palestinian fighters have destroyed more than 40 Israeli military vehicles in the past 72 hours. Qassam brigade said resistance fighters had also killed 25 Israeli soldiers and injured dozens since Monday. Palestinian fighters have also struck Israeli command centers and military gatherings with mortar shells and short-range missiles. The military wing of the Islamic Jihad movement says it also targeted regime forces in Gaza City with rockets and mortars. The U.S.-based monitoring group says Palestinian fighters continue to use, quote, sophisticated tactics in the battle against Israeli forces. New clashes have taken place between Hezbollah resistance movement and the Israeli regime along Lebanon's southern border. Hezbollah has launched a drone strike on an Israeli military position in the occupied Shabbat farms. The regime's military positions in the Margaliot area have also been targeted with rockets. Our Beirut correspondent Mariam Saleh joins us now with more details. Mariam, what do you have for us?
Well, we definitely see an intensification of the Israeli shelling, and therefore also Hezbollah reciprocates with resistance operations that are basically equal to the level of the aggression. And they said that in their statements. We saw that yesterday, and even throughout this round of confrontations, the Israelis have been stepping up their aggression by directly targeting civilian houses more and more on a daily basis, in addition to the fact that they continue to target areas that could include civilians that are further off from the border. We even see them targeting natural reserves, national parks, and things like that. So we have definitely seen that the Israelis are taking steps that are not acceptable by the resistance, and so therefore we see that Hezbollah is stepping up their operations. Today, of course, we had several operations. There were at least seven operations. Two of them were conducted in the middle of the night in response to the targeting and the killing of a civilian. Today, also, we had the martyrdom of a civilian woman in the town of Marun Ar-Ras. She and her husband were in the house, which was supposed to be a bit further off from the border, although this is a bordering town, but they did not expect maybe the shelling to reach that area, but that house specifically was targeted. The woman has become a martyr, and we have her husband is severely injured. The resistance specifically retaliated for this, naming the woman in person. They directly said that this is in retaliation when they targeted the Kiryat Shmona camp. And so therefore, you can see how it is always clear that once there is the fall of civilians in Lebanon, there is always, of course, a response by using Katyusha rockets by the resistance and targeting settlements that could also include inhabitants and settlers from the Israeli side. But you also have something new, which is the fact that Hezbollah said that they will be reciprocal when it comes to how they target things. So if the Israelis target a civilian house, they will try to also destroy the settlements. We've seen that in Mutalib also today, and the fact that they also targeted a Merkava tank. We also saw that Hezbollah used drones today again to target gatherings of soldiers in towns that are Abuvim and Doviv, which are considered the occupied Lebanese town of Salha. And so Hezbollah has also been very clear on naming the towns with their original name, whether it were Lebanese or Palestinian, and not and using, of course, at the same time, the Hebrew name, which was newly named from these places by the Israelis. But it seems that definitely Hezbollah is reciprocal when it comes to their retaliation. The Israeli shelling has reached areas like that are also beyond the border. We're talking about, in addition to Kfar Kila, of course, Marun al-Ras, Yarun, which are on the border, you also have towns like Taibe, you have towns like Iblis Saqi, you have towns like Rashay al-Fukhar. These are places that are a bit further off and not expected to be shelled by the Israelis. So you have what seems to be a growing confrontation, despite the fact that we are not looking at a full-scale war onto Lebanon. It is still somewhat in the boundaries of the bordering towns and the ones close to that. But we do see, of course, definitely a high intensity of this fire exchange. We also saw that Hezbollah targeted Israeli gatherings beyond the post of the Shabbat farms in Kfar Shuba Hills. Before you said, we have clear posts that you can see in the Shabbat farms in the Kfar Shuba Hills for the Israelis. Hezbollah targeted those on several occasions. However, today specifically, they said that they targeted the new situated posts for the Israelis and the barracks that were put just recently. The Israelis pulling backwards while Hezbollah continues to strike them, even into those areas which they believe are not under the scrutiny of the resistance. Of course, at the same time, we hear a lot of continuous warnings by Hezbollah's officials, whether it is the political officials or the head, the secretary general, deputy secretary general, stressing that Hezbollah will not hesitate to retaliate if the Israelis do target civilians. And we've seen that on two occasions recently. We don't know whether the Israelis are taking different steps further, but we hear a lot of talk when it comes through the Israeli media from Israeli officials saying that what they are confronting in the Galilee region is something that is unacceptable. It is something that is causing a huge crisis when it comes to the settlers. Many settlers have said they will not return, even if there is a truce or even if there is some sort of a ceasefire, because they believe that they saw what happened on October 7th, what Hamas did. Hezbollah can do much more than that. And so therefore, they are not willing to stay in anywhere which is at the border with Lebanon or at the border with Gaza, of course. And so they believe that Hezbollah has the capabilities which exceeds that of the Hamas resistance. And this is why we have a huge crisis coming up within the Israeli regime. How they are going to deal with that, we see a lot of mediation, a lot of pressure that continues on a daily basis from the United States, from France, from other European states as well, that feel that they can probably have an impact on the political spectrum in Lebanon. They're playing a few cards in Lebanon to see if they can put pressure on the resistance to stop its operations as well. Try to even pull Hezbollah backwards. The Israelis say that based on 1701, Hezbollah's resistance should not be in the southern parts of the Laitania River. Of course, we're talking about the bordering towns. All of them are south of the Laitani. And so this is why we see a lot of pressure on that side, because the Israeli officials have also warned that they would launch a full-scale war, while the resistance has also warned the Israelis that if they do, nothing can protect them. Not the U.S. vessels, not the U.S. Support, the political support, whether in the United Nations or anything. And so therefore, they have been adamant on saying that they will support the resistance in Gaza, while at the same time protecting the civilians in Lebanon.
Thank you very much for that. Mariam Saleh there from Beirut. We appreciate it.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yalda, the longest night. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. The sunset of the 30th of the Iranian month of Azar marks the longest night of the year. Iranians have been marking this occasion since old times. They call it Yalda. This night is celebrated with recitation of epic poems of Shahnameh or lyric poems of Hafez and Saadi. This is accompanied by eating nuts and fruits. Ancient Iranians believed that on the longest night of the year, the devilish darkness would perish, and they would keep vigil till the sunrise of the next day that marked the first day of winter. They used to light fires till morning. Iranians would get together and enjoy themselves reading poems and recounting stories of the past. The word Yalda is a Syriac word meaning birth and generation. Its connotation can be that of the sun's birth after the longest night. Ancient Iranians maintained that on the night of Yalda, Mitra or Mehr would return to the world and make days longer. Thus, the sun would dominate over the earth once again. Yalda has also been called Shabe Chelle or Chelle night. Chelle derives from Chehel, meaning 40 in Farsi. According to the old text, there were Chelle Bozorg, that is big 40, and Chelle Kuchak, or little 40, that was in fact 20 days. The first 40 days of winter were the big 40, and the next 20 days constituted the little 40. These two periods cover 2 months of winter. Ancient Iranians used to celebrate natural events such as summer revolution or climax of warmth in summer and winter revolution or the climax of cold in winter. Yalda has been marked in Iran till this day. According to the Jalali calendar that began to be used for registering time since 5th century AH, from the first of the Iranian month of day, that is the day following Yalda night, days would become longer, and that meant the death of the demon of cold and birth of the sun. Yalda entered the Iranian calendar since 502 BC during the rule of Dariush the First. The winter revolution is the start of winter, and from then on, the days become longer and longer. This natural event has caused many ethnicities to hold feast. Yalda has been marked from the Great Khorasan up to Kashmir. In Afghanistan, parts of Pakistan, and north of India, Yalda night is called Shabe Chelle Kalan, or the Big 40 night. Tajik people mark this night with customs that resemble those of Iranians very much. The nuts and fruits constitute the main part of Yalda night customs. Women in different parts of Iran make the local pastries for that night. Pistachio, hazelnut, walnut, almond, and so on are the inseparable part of Yalda nuts. Watermelon is also very common on this night. Pomegranate is another fruit of this table. Watermelon and pomegranate are served as they are red, and red is the color of life and vividness. In the past, it was customary to eat snow lumps with grape juice on Yalda night. Other things that are usual on Yalda night include dried palm, apricot, peach, apple, fig, blackberry, and raisin. As it was said in the beginning of the program, Shahnameh of Ferdowsi and the Divan of Hafez are usually read out by the elderly of the families at the table. The customs of Yalta Night have undergone changes throughout centuries. Yet, what is of great significance in this ceremony is the fact that families and relatives gather together in the house of their grandparents and they recount them of the past. Visiting the Eleli and sitting with them is highly recommended in Islam as it keeps the familial bonds firm and helps resolve problems. Moreover, it is a good opportunity for the youngsters to exchange experiences with the elderly and learn many things from them. Familial parties and gatherings have decreased in the West as family and parents have lost their real value and meaning. But Islam puts high emphasis on familial bonds and respect for the elderly and kindness toward the youngsters. Yalta Night is a good opportunity to be together, share happiness, and get familiar with each other's problems.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Hidden Files. Over 80% of the world's population uses a smartphone, but what over 80% of the world's population probably never thinks about is the true cost of the cobalt used in the batteries of smartphones, laptops, and electric vehicles. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashemi. And today we're going to tell you a story of hands. Hands that have for long been hurt beyond imagination while harvesting the main ingredients to our industries. But before we start today's story, we need to properly set the scene, because though the country we're going to talk about is home to one of the poorest nations in the world, the land itself is perhaps the richest land on earth, or the country in question. The Democratic Republic of Congo, the country with the most abundant resources known on earth, and yet home to one of the 10 most impoverished nations in the world. But it was at the hands of these impoverished people that Europe experienced its industrial boom in the late 1800s. And it all started with some of the same trees that you saw in the picture, the rubber tree. From bicycle tires to industrial bands, rubber played a big role in answering Europeans' daily demands, especially with the rubber boom in the mid-1800s. But rubber does not grow in Europe. And that's where the story of a Belgian king and his Congo comes in. The story about the toil of hands and their unlikely reward. Now, who was this Belgian king we're talking about, and what did he do?
King Leopold II was born to the first royal family following Belgium's independence. He seized Congo with the help of the explorer Henry Morton Stanley in mid-1880s. The king and his forces drained the land of resources, killing elephants for ivory and cutting down trees for rubber. The United States became the first country to recognize his claim to the Congo. Congolese hands were systematically amputated during his rule. The severed hands were then collected and smoked by the colonists to be preserved for later counting and recording. King Leopold was responsible for the biggest genocide in history, with 10 to 15 million killed by torture, famine, and diseases, and many others systematically maimed. The king was honored with Great Britain's most prestigious title, a member of the Order of the Garter, in 1916. Thousands of signatures and recent protests by Belgian people have called for the removal of his statues and the payment of reparations to the victims of the colonial crimes.
The people were clearly being punished for something, but that something was neither negligence nor a crime. Their Belgian masters had decided a certain rubber quota for them to harvest, and they'd failed to reach their quota. But it wasn't only these slaves who had to pay for this failure. Let's just say the Belgian punishment system for the Congolese who hadn't met their quota included cutting off the hands and feet of their loved ones. According to statistics, between 10 to 15 million Congolese were killed by King Leopold II during his 23 years of ownership of Congo. And though this number is millions more than the number of those killed in other genocides, few people know about Congo's Holocaust. At the time, this genocide committed by the Belgians slashed Congo's population in half. Imagine that, half of the population gone. But it's best to hear about all of this from one of our guests today, who is a historian specializing in colonialism in Africa.
Brothomeo Gabriel is an activist and a member of an anti-colonialist imperialist organization called No White Saviors in Uganda. He specializes in African history, and with the organization, they have opened a Pan-African library in Kampala. He's also a social media expert and uses this specialty to educate the masses about the true history of Africa.
Thank you so much for being with us on the program today. Can you talk about the legacy of the Belgian king, King Leopold II, that legacy that he had on Congo?
We first have to highlight how, unlike other colonies, or unlike other entities that were classified as colonies, Leopold classified the Congo as a private property. It's vast land that had people on it, that had resources, that had landscapes and animals, was essentially the private property of one individual. And with that came his self-imposed right to whatever he saw fit to exploit the people of the land however he saw fit. And the fact that it was private property meant that even the Belgian government, if I may say, at that time, all the Belgian political bodies didn't have a right to dictate or to interfere in whatever decision he took. And we see that with this came a reign of terror for the Congolese people, for the Congolese, Rwandan, and Burundian people. Because when we often talk about the Congo talk about Belgium, we often leave out the fact that Rwanda and Burundi also faced similar atrocities at the hands of the Belgians.
I mean, it's estimated up to 15 million Congolese were killed during Leopold's reign. Do you think that these numbers are accurate?
It could have possibly been more than 15 million. I'm one of the people who believe it was more than 15 million because when you look at the systemic situation as it was, the fact that for every hand that was chopped, it had to be accounted for. Every bullet that was fired had to be accounted for. So that meant taking back the arms of the victim or the hands of the victim back to the first public officials. I think that's how the force was referred to at that time. I'm not quite good with my French isn't quite good. But you see that the institutional or systemic system as it was at that point promoted violence against the Congolese people. For any small thing, you could have fallen short on your rubber collection and, you know, your child would pay the price or your family member would pay the price. Even you yourself would pay the price. So imagine that going on for years, day in, day out, years. It's easy for anyone to see that 10 million is an understatement.
What exactly is happening today in Congo? Because we see growing calls by the Congolese for the United Nations to even leave the country.
Yes, they are cries by the Congolese population to have MONUSCO expelled. I think MONUSCO is the UN mission in Congo, something like that. And it isn't for, and this cause is for a justified reason by the Congolese people that throughout the decades that the MONUSCO has been active, they have questioned their input because the Congolese people are being slaughtered. And oftentimes you see that the MONUSCO entity doesn't act, or the UN entity doesn't act only when it benefits them. I don't know if you're aware, but I think it was last year, a UN truck in the eastern part of the Congo overturned, and out of the vehicle came bags of minerals. So for the Congolese people, they are literally tired of being exploited. They're literally tired of this pseudo-sense of oh, we're here to protect you, because that is not what is ongoing. The UN is plundering the wealth of the Congolese people, the wealth of the Congolese land.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today on Hidden Files. Though many of the horror stories in Congo's past involve rubber slavery, the oppression of this nation today has far more to do with another type of resource. You see, in addition to its limitless water supply, rich forests, and fertile soil, Congo is home to some of the world's most precious and most used minerals. Congo has abundant mineral deposits of cobalt, gold, diamonds, petroleum, potash, lead, zinc, uranium, copper, phosphates, gold, manganese, natural gas, coltan, and a whole lot more. Congo's untapped raw deposits of raw materials are actually estimated at being $24 trillion. Imagine that, $24 trillion. And Congo is the world's fourth largest producer of copper, copper that we use so much in this modern world of ours. 60% of the coltan on the planet, the reserves are in Congo. And perhaps most importantly, the country produces 70% of the world's cobalt, which is used in phones and laptops and other high-tech tools. You see, it's the Congolese who are the true owners of the cobalt. It's the Congolese who harvest it with their hands in unsafe mines. And it's the Congolese who suffer all kinds of health issues and birth defects as a result of this dangerous hands-on approach to cobalt harvest. And yet, in 2018, over 70% of the Congolese lived on less than $1.90 a day. Clearly, even though their country is no longer the private property of a Belgian king, they continue to have little to no share in their rich national resources. But how is this happening today in what's now called the DRC, or the Democratic Republic of Congo? Our next guest has some interesting answers, so let's find out more.
Tede Kofi is a broadcast journalist with credits on the BBC World Service and BBC Radio 5, where he presented Current Affairs magazine programs. Tet is a newspaper publisher and ran the Ethnic Media Group, publishing Asian and Afro-Caribbean titles. He has been a crisis, media coach, and consultant for multinational corporations, specializing in the arena of diversity management.
Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. We appreciate you being with us today on the program. I want your assessment of the effects of Leopold Reign you think could have had on the overall psyche of the Congolese.
The barbarity, the savagery, and the cruelty that Leopold II wreaked on the Congo is one of the world's best-kept secrets. It is estimated that 10 million Congolese died, that he reduced the population of the country by about 70%. In the early days of Leopold, each Congolese man, able-bodied man, was supposed to produce 15 kilograms of rubber per day. If he did not produce that, his family would be rounded up, herded, and killed. And so if people didn't produce their quota, their hands were amputated. There were these bizarre scenes of people presenting like strings of male genitalia, Congolese male genitalia, just to show how many people that they had killed that day because they hadn't made their quota. Now, all of this was covered up by Leopold as an exercise in civilizing the savages, which we Africans were presented as. So he said that basically in the Congo Free State, which is basically my private fiefdom, I've gone over there to introduce them to God and Christianity. And of course, the missionaries were under dire admonitions never to reveal the truth, which of course ultimately leaked, because as slavery was abolished elsewhere, people started to ask questions about how Leopold was running this enterprise. And of course, the whole thing blew up in his face. And he then had to resort to burning all the national records to try and cover up and hide a genocide, which was, you know, in plain view. So again, this is another way in which, if you have lived through that kind of, let me call it a Holocaust, it's probably the greatest human genocide kind of in living memory. If you've been through that kind of genocide, the idea is to instill in the people obedience to authority and power.
How is it, though, that the exploitation of the Democratic Republic of Congo is still existing today, has taken place for so long a period of time?
The oldest playbook in method in the playbook of any totalitarian or any controller is divide and rule. Divide and rule requires that because there are few of the abusers, you must get the people you are abusing to fight each other. As long as they are fighting each other, they cannot unite, because it is only when they are united that they can kick you out of your position of authority, command, and control. And so it is that Congo has always been destabilized by foreign powers and foreign interests who have a profound desire, but whose lifestyles are determined by the cheapness with which they can extract the strategic minerals that I listed before.
Right.
And so that is how it's played out for the Congo. And another way is to make sure that you have proxy governments which are propped up by foreign powers, doing essentially the bidding of the foreign powers so that they can be the natural and easy exfiltration of the nation's wealth to the benefit of the foreign powers. So that's how it's always played. Divide and rule. Proxy governments, which are created by the foreign powers. And thus it has been to this very day. In fact, now there is another challenge because colonialism moved to another stage when, by using local agents, the destabilization could be maintained. And even now, if you speak to any Congolese, they will tell you that the role of Rwanda is a very difficult one in their country. And many Congolese blame a lot of the conflicts, internal conflicts within the country, on the actions not only of the Rwandese, but also of the Ugandans.
Well, why haven't we seen reparations for the Congolese after all of the suffering that they have gone through?
For a crime to be expunged, you need recognition that the crime happened, you need regret for the crime happening, and you need recompense. Now, in terms of recognition of the crime happening, my goodness, if you ask anybody what comes out of Congo, what they'll tell you is Makalele, Vincent Kompany, Lualua, and Romelu Lukaku, their top football players. Most people in the world don't even know what the history of the Congo is beyond some trite superficial modernities. In terms of regret, when the tooth of Patrice Lumumba was handed back to his family, here is the thing. There was no official apology, either on behalf of the Belgian state or on behalf of Leopold II, who committed most of those atrocities. So there is no regret there. And as for compensation, well, Congo's wealth is still being filched out of the country on a daily basis. And the parties who benefit from this are absolutely adamant about the maintenance of their profits. So it's a perfect storm for Africa's richest country. And you've got to think about the bigger picture as well. When Nkrumah stood up in Ghana, the independence of Africa was signaled. When Lumumba stood up in the Congo, the independence of the Congo was signaled. And the thing about these things is that they attract people who follow the cause. And so it is important in the interest of the controlling powers that Congo doesn't become as wealthy as she can be. What if then she starts supporting the rest of the other African countries, and then the yoke of colonialism will be broken one by one by one across the continent? If you want to defeat an enemy, you first defeat their champion, and Congo can be the champion of Africa. Just indeed, as Muammar Gaddafi could have been the champion of Africa. Look what happened to him.
Well, what is it going to take, in your perspective, to turn around the fate of the Democratic Republic of Congo?
All I can say is that if people are severely abused over a long period of time, it takes time for these people to heal, for them to find their center, and to make demands based on their own self-validation. So that work has to take place. But that work has to take place right now in the face of overwhelming media coverage, which makes sure that the only things people associate Congo with is Claude Makélélé and Victor Kompany, football players. People don't know outside of Africa the value and the condition of Congo. So all of this applies very, very negative pressure. On the other hand, the international community must write a new set of rules. And that set of rules should mean that all people, as said in the United Nations Charter, deserve respect and recognition. But at the moment, you know, the world is run by what one cartoonist called the golden rule. He who has the gold makes the rules. And so as long as you've got this sort of moral relativism, it's going to be very challenging.
Thank you so much for being with us, Mr. Tete Kufi. Appreciate it. But when we talk about the advancement of technology, we often think of prestigious universities and creative minds. Unfortunately, we rarely remember the suffering of hands without whose harvest the main ingredients of advancement would be missing. Hands like those of the Congolese that were cut off for the sake of rubber and the harvest of cobalt. The pain must be acknowledged and the price be paid. But from the Belgian monarchy that has brought about the genocide of the Congolese to the international corporations and various countries that continue to profit from the toil of the Congolese and the taking away of their resources, no entity has acknowledged the crime committed against these people, let alone apologize. Yet even a formal apology can hardly ever appease the victims of such horrible crimes. What good would an apology have done, for instance, the Congolese man who had to stare in shock at the severed body parts of his 5-year-old daughter? I can't even begin to imagine. Well, a true apology must be followed by a change in actions and in reparations, such as those that has for decades been paid by German citizens to those related to victims of Nazi atrocities. Perhaps someday soon, the oppressed nations of the world will begin to have the power to extract this apology from colonial powers of the past and present. But this power requires knowledge. For now, though, that's goodbye for me and all the crew right here at Hidden Files. Thank you so much for being with us, and let us hear from you, from your corner of the world. I'm Marzia Hashimi.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.